So Mr. Chase, whenever you're ready.
All right, well, I appreciate it. Of course, my name is Dane Chase. I'm here on behalf of Reginald McCoy. This case concerns a First Step Act proceeding, and the central issue is whether the district court was bound by the original sentencing court's guidelines drug quantity finding of 2,848.5 grams of crack cocaine. And the answer is simply no. Under this court's precedent in a First Act proceeding, the court is only bound by a previous drug quantity finding that could have been used to determine the defendant's statutory penalty at the time of sentencing. Under the Perez and Coy cases cited in Mr. McCoy's initial brief, the original sentencing court could only make a statutory drug quantity finding that would increase the statutory penalty if the defendant was given pre-sentencing notice of the quantity necessary to trigger the increased penalty.
Mr. Chase, can I ask you a quick question? So the could have been used language comes from Jones and Jackson, right?
Correct.
And I mean, you acknowledge, I assume, that the immediate concern in those cases was Apprendi. So I guess reading that language in context, wouldn't it be reasonable to say that could have been used meant could have been used vis-a-vis Apprendi, not could have been used sort of vis-a-vis the universe?
Yeah, I think that that would be a correct reading of that. Could have been used under the Apprendi line of cases and under Apprendi or before Apprendi. So yeah, I don't believe that the Apprendi line of cases, frankly, have anything to do with what we're arguing.
Well, I guess what I mean then is, in this case then, because your client was sentenced 9 years before Apprendi came down, why is it that the previous drug quantity finding could not have been used in your client's case?
Well, there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, because it's a guidelines finding as opposed to a statutory finding. So in our case, the court didn't explicitly find that for statutory purposes, I find it's 2,000 and whatever grams of crack cocaine. That's a complete guidelines finding, which means it could be inclusive and probably was inclusive of relevant conduct, which would not be appropriate for a statutory finding. So that finding really doesn't represent a statutory finding. And because it could be and probably is inclusive of that relevant conduct, it could not at this point be used as a statutory finding. You'd have to parse out whatever the court determined was relevant conduct and then go from there. But also, once the court determined that a drug quantity was at least 50 grams, the inquiry was at an end at that point. A finding of any additional amount had no statutory significance to the court, and the court was therefore unable or was beyond the court's power to make a finding that went beyond 50 grams. And the reason I say that, or I would cite to, it's a case, Pricer v. Newkirk, 422 U.S. 395. But anyway, under that case, because the court's guidelines finding of 2,848.5 grams should only be used as a statutory finding to the extent that the court found 50 grams, because anything beyond the 50 grams was effectively just an advisory finding or an advisory opinion that couldn't be made by the court. It was beyond the court's power to make. So that, I think, would be the distinguishing factor is that we simply don't have an actual statutory finding of anything beyond 50 grams, and the court was unable, it was beyond the court's power to even make a finding beyond 50 grams. So to the extent that the court made a guideline finding of 2,848.5 grams for the guidelines, only 50 grams of that could actually be considered to be a statutory finding.
I just want to make sure that I sort of understand your position. I guess I thought that your position was, look, this court announced a principle in Jones and Jackson that the previous finding, we have to determine whether the previous finding could have been used. But now I think we agree that Jones and Jackson, what Jones and Jackson really meant was could have been used validly under Apprendi. We don't have an Apprendi problem here, but it seems like you say there's like this more general principle that emerges from Jones and Jackson, this could have been used principle that you then say would be violated by reference to a different line of cases, the Perez and Coy cases that say without notice of the consequences of factual findings, there's a due process violation of sort of a different stripe.
That's exactly correct. We're not going under the Apprendi line of cases. We're saying that there's a totally different violation here. And because there was no notice of this, if we kind of pretend that we're back at the sentencing hearing, which is what the First Step Act reforms are asking us to do, because there was no notice of this 280-gram threshold, the court couldn't make that finding. They weren't allowed to. And the reason for that is, again, because Mr. McCoy and his counsel would have had no notice. They would have had no reason to contest any amount beyond 50 grams. And so you can't at this point hold that against him.
So just a quick question. Why wouldn't Jones and Jackson themselves, the defendants in those cases, have benefited from the same rule? Well, why didn't they win?
In that circumstance, because nobody made, from what I understand, and I, you know, of course, could be wrong, but my reading of those cases is nobody ever contested the fact that there wasn't a proper statutory finding. What they're saying is there was a statutory finding made, and therefore, you know, because of Apprendi, we should redefine what that actual finding was. What we're saying is there isn't even a statutory finding to begin with. The only statutory finding was 50 grams. So we're not asking you to redefine anything. We're just asking you to defer to the only finding that could have and was in fact made for statutory purposes, which was 50 grams.
Let's walk it back a little bit and think about what a district court judge is doing at sentencing with regards to drug quantity. No one knows at the time a defendant is sentenced whether or not the statutory sentencing scheme is going to be changed in the future. And even if it is changed, how it's going to be changed.
Right.
So your position is that a judge can only make a finding up to a statutory threshold at the time and nothing else?
Yes, at this point, because there's no purpose to be served by finding anything additional to that. So once you find 50 grams, there's nothing in controversy. There's nothing under the statute that makes a difference. There's no significance to that finding, and it's effectively an advisory opinion at that point.
But doesn't it make a difference, or can't it make a difference for where in a range the district court judge imposes a sentence? I mean, some of these ranges, maybe not with regards to crack cocaine, but with regards to other drugs, and certainly many decades ago, the ranges were pretty big. And there was a difference as to where you should be sentenced if you trafficked in 1 kilogram of cocaine or you trafficked in 25 kilograms of cocaine. So judges can't make that finding either when they're trying to do it for guideline purposes.
No. What I'm saying is they absolutely can for guideline purposes, but what you can't do is then take that guideline finding and then convert it over to a statutory finding. So there are two totally different findings at that point. So for guideline purposes, yes, the court can and should make that finding because, again, like you just said, it's certainly going to make a difference, or at least should, I would think, make a difference to what the ultimate sentencing range is and what the sentence imposed is. But for purposes of the statute, the only thing that matters is 50 grams. It doesn't matter if it's 51, 5,000, anything beyond 50 is all the same. So for statutory purposes, the court would be precluded from finding anything beyond the 50 grams.
Mr. Chase, I guess I'm not quite following what the difference is between a statutory finding and a guideline finding. The pre-sentence report published to the parties that there were 2,848 grams being attributed to the defendant. The defendant had an opportunity to raise an objection to that finding and litigate that question before the district judge at sentencing. There was no objection from what I understand. And so that finding, that preliminary finding in the pre-sentence report was adopted by the district court without objection. So I understand, I certainly understand that I'm sympathetic to the concern raised, the due process issue raised, that perhaps had the defendant known that 280 grams would be a relevant threshold, that perhaps he would have litigated that question. But there was a finding. There was a finding that could have been litigated and was not. And I guess I don't understand the distinction you're making between a guideline finding and a statutory finding.
Well, for one, the guideline finding, again, can be and is inclusive of relevant conduct. And relevant conduct wouldn't be an appropriate consideration for a statutory finding. So they are two totally different findings, number one. And number two, for the guidelines, it was relevant. It did make a difference. It had significance in that it was going to be used to determine what his actual guidelines were going to be set at. So the court had the authority to make that finding and should make that finding. It wasn't an advisory situation, whereas with the statutory finding, again, it was just advisory. It made no sense. It made and had no purpose and would have then therefore been beyond the court's authority to make.
So what do you do then with, we have a number of cases, and I can't recall their names off the top of my head, which say that in a First Step Act proceeding, you can't go back and relitigate or challenge prior factual findings made by a district court with regards to drug quantity.
Right.
What do we do with those cases?
Well, I think it still holds because in our case, again, the only finding for statutory purposes that could have and would have been made was the 50 grams. So you're bound by the only factual finding that could have been properly made, which again is the 50 grams. So I think everything holds. I think it's actually in harmony, and we're actually just asking you to do exactly what those cases tell us to do, and that is to uphold whatever finding was actually made or could have been made. And again, in our case, it, obviously they found 50 grams because they sentenced him under that statutory scheme and are under those statutes. And so since that was the only finding that could have been and therefore was made, we're asking that to be enforced.
Well, and do you think, I'm sorry, go ahead, Judge.
No, please go ahead.
Do you think this three-judge panel is empowered to do that under Jones, or would it require en banc?
Oh, I think you're absolutely entitled to do it under Jones because we're working within the Jones framework. We're doing exactly what they said, that, you know, the court is bound by a previous drug finding. And in our case, the only previous drug finding for statutory purposes would have and could have been, or could have and would have, it is only 50 grams because there was no authority to make a finding beyond that.
Under that rationale, now that a different threshold matters, is the district court in a First Step Act proceeding empowered to then make findings?
Under Concepcion, I wouldn't say that they're empowered to make findings in terms of to raise the statutory threshold. The statutory threshold finding is what it is, and it was 50 grams. Now, under the Concepcion case, the court could make a finding and say, you know, under the guidelines, and I'm gonna vary, I'm gonna consider that, and I'm gonna vary under that circumstance. So, kind of indirectly, the court could make a finding, but I don't think that they can change the statutory finding period.
Well, but you're saying that the only finding you can make is the statutory threshold.
That's correct.
Anything else would be advisory.
That's correct for purposes of the statutory finding.
But now it's no longer advisory. So if you're right, why isn't the district court judge, if we were to remand this case, for example, now say, okay, the 11th Circuit has said that the finding back then was 50 because anything else over and above would have been an advisory opinion. But now that's no longer an advisory opinion. So now I have to decide what the drug amount attributable to Mr. McCoy was.
Because we're looking at the time frame of the original sentencing hearing. So at the original sentencing hearing, nothing would change. It would still be advisory as concerning the original sentencing here. So the only finding that could have been made at that original sentencing hearing, which is the only finding that matters, is the 50 grams. And they're bound by that. The district court is now bound by that.
So you're saying that in every single case, the statutory threshold is the upper limit of the drug quantity finding, and that anything else over and above that has to be disregarded.
That's correct, for statutory purposes, not for guidelines purposes, for statutory purposes.
And it can never be revisited by the First Step Act court?
Not under this court's line of precedent, no.
Okay. All right, Mr. Chase, thank you very much. You reserved your time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Rhodes.
Good morning. May it please the court. McCoy is a recidivist drug dealer whose latest offenses involved over 2,100 grams of crack cocaine. As a result, he was subject to a mandatory life sentence in 1991. And here the district court rightly determined that because the reduced penalties of the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010 could not have benefited McCoy, it lacked authority to reduce his mandatory life sentence under the First Step Act of 2018. And the court alternatively determined that the 3553A factors did support a reduction regardless of his eligibility. And for these reasons, McCoy hasn't met his burden of establishing that he was eligible for an FSA reduction, or that the court abused its discretion in denying him one. And thus we ask the court to affirm the order of the district court. And with regard specifically to the argument, and I have to say that I'm still having a difficult time wrapping my arms around or my head around the argument that was made. First, in these proceedings, the defendant has the burden of showing eligibility for reduction under the First Step Act. And with regard to the arguments that have been put forth here, first of all, I'm not quite sure. I don't think that the record supports the first premise, which is that the court only made a guidelines finding and not a statutory finding with regard to the 2,800 grams of crack cocaine that were involved in this case. And it seems...
Well, I think Ms. Rhodes, that you're right about that, but I think Mr. Chase's argument, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but his argument is that we need to say that the guideline finding is not the same as the statutory finding, and that the statutory finding, because it's the only one that makes a difference, stops at the statutory threshold. That's the argument. So,
well, but the pre-sentence report said, as Judge Grimberg noted, that the guidelines sentence was life because the mandatory minimum sentence was life. And that's ordinarily how that works in these proceedings. And that was premised on the undisputed fact that these offenses involved 2,800 grams of crack cocaine. And all of this seems to be an attempt to assert a due process claim under Perez and Core, and perhaps even under Jones and Jackson, which the defendant cannot make in a post-sentencing proceeding such as this. Bravo says that other cases have adopted that. And if this court were to rule otherwise, then this would turn this proceeding, it would allow the defendant to, in other words, assert a super 2255 motion and to try to attempt to obtain relief in this proceeding where he could not have obtained it any other proceeding. He might have been able to attain it on direct appeal, but he didn't assert this issue on direct appeal. And if he's saying that it's not really an Apprendi issue, then the fact that Apprendi hadn't been decided wouldn't have been a bar to him asserting this. And so the opportunity for him to assert it, this Perez Coy reliance on the drug quantity finding at sentencing is long past due. And the order is due to be affirmed on that basis.
Okay, help me out with how things would have played out with Mr. McCoy had he been sentenced today, just to understand where the argument is coming from. If he had been sentenced today, his initial crack cocaine statutory threshold would have been lower, right? Or no? If he were sentenced today.
Yes. The initial statutory penalty would have been lower, but
been what? I'm sorry.
I was agreeing with your premise, but by operation of the fact that the defendant also had the two prior felony convictions, and given the amount of crack cocaine involved in this case, that bumped up his statutory penalty to mandatory life.
If the finding at the initial sentencing had been just the 50 grams, the minimum to hit the statutory threshold, would he had still been subject to a life sentence? a statutory life sentence?
No.
What would do you know where he would have been statutorily?
Quite frankly, I do not.
Okay.
Let me ask you this, Ms. Rhodes, and this is really just a question about due process and fundamental fairness. And I want to kind of hear your views about this. And I'm not saying this necessarily applies to Mr. McCoy, but more broadly. Let's say in this scenario, the defendant receives the pre-sentence report and it shows that he's being attributed 2,848 grams of crack cocaine. At the time, all he knows is that the statutory enhancement's going to kick in after 50 grams. Mm-hmm. Say he has a decent argument that he should only be held to, let's say, 200 grams, right? Let's say based on his theory of defense, he should only be held attributed to 200 grams. But he discusses that with his lawyer, and his lawyer tells him, look, it's not going to make a difference because even under our best case scenario, you're going to be attributed to 200 grams and nothing beyond 50 makes a difference. So we might as well not object to this finding in the pre-sentence report. It's going to go over better with the district judge to not necessarily litigate this question. So let's not raise an objection because it's not going to make a difference. Mm-hmm. All right. And here we are today now where we know it does make a difference, because if he had been held attributed to only 200 grams below the 280 gram threshold, it would make a difference. From a due process standpoint, what do we do about that?
Well, Bravo says that you can't do anything about it, because Bravo says that in these proceedings, that's an extraneous constitutional issue that is not cognizable, that the district court doesn't have the authority to remedy that due process violation in these proceedings. And fundamentally, that's my answer. And in this particular scenario where we're talking about 2,800 grams, where even if the threshold is 280 grams, saying I don't want to fight about it wouldn't necessarily have resulted. The equities in that situation aren't nearly as dire or clear cut as the equities in the situation that you raised. But Bravo says we don't consider those types of issues in these type of post conviction proceedings.
Thank you.
Because otherwise, as has been noted in several of the First Step Back decisions, this is just another opportunity for a collateral challenge to a sentence, which is not cognizable in this type of scenario. There were many opportunities for him to make the very argument that he's making now, especially because they said that Perez and Coy applied at sentencing. And if there's some reason for them to say, you should only be stuck with the 50 gram quantity in determining what my statutory penalties are and my guidelines penalties should be, the opportunity to make that argument was present on direct appeal. Also, perhaps on 2255, and as far as I can tell from the voluminous number of collateral challenges to the defendant's sentence, that argument wasn't made heretofore.
But he didn't know back then that 280 would be a relevant threshold, did he?
No. But there was no challenge whatsoever, not even to the 50. I understand there's a certain appeal to that, but I'm just saying that I haven't come across any authority which would have allowed the defendant to assert this in these proceedings. And I see that I'm at the 5-minute mark. So I just would like to address, before I run out of time, the alternative ruling that the 3553A factors counsel against a reduction in this case. That ruling should carry the day in these proceedings. And the defendant said that it shouldn't, and he attacks the exercise of the district court's discretion, namely saying that the court failed to calculate what the guidelines range could have been. Well, there was no dispute. The defendant asserted that the guidelines range could have been 295 to 365 months. The only problem with that was that it was actually a little bit lower. It was 292 to 365 months. They asserted that as the appropriate guidelines range in numerous pleadings, which the district court chronicled in the order. And so there was no dispute. So there's no need to send this back for a recalculation of the guidelines range because nobody disputed what it was. And the court also went way overboard providing McCoy with his day in court. The district court provided him with a hearing and he was present at that hearing. And that's not even required in this scenario. And the court said that it entertained, it was six motions and about a dozen or so supplemental motions. And the court said that it considered all of those. And the court specifically asked during the hearing for McCoy to assert which of the 3553A factors supported his request for a sentence reduction. He did not do that. I mean, he did do that. And he brought about his age. He said he had family support. He said numerous things that the court listened to in a 30-minute hearing and said that it considered in the order. And his main problem with the order is that the court didn't address the arguments that he had made in support of the 3553A factors or anything else for that matter. And the court said that it did. And if it's his burden to prove that the court didn't mean what it said and didn't do what it said, then he needs to come forth with some type of evidence to support that, and that hasn't happened. And all of this is to say that the abuse of discretion standard requires that there be some clear manifestation of an error in judgment in weighing the 3553 factors and the facts and circumstances of the case. And this record supports none of that. The court gave a well-reasoned explanation for why this motion was to be denied. The court talked about the extensive quantity of crack cocaine that was involved. The court talked about his extensive decades-long record of prison infractions, some of which were very violent offenses that concerned the court, which the court said showed that he was disrespectful of the rule of law and also a danger to the community and a possible recidivist. And the court said, all in balance, that the 3553A factors counseled against a discretionary reduction in this case. This court in these proceedings does not reweigh 3553A factors. It has said that repeatedly. And because the order itself shows a well-reasoned consideration, the facts and circumstances of the case and the arguments of the defendant, we ask that if nothing else, the court affirm the order of the district court based on the alternative ruling that the 3553A factors counseled against a reduction in this case.
Ms. Rode, before you finish up, do you think we can assume eligibility to get to that alternative ground, or we have to address eligibility first?
You can. I don't think you necessarily have to assume eligibility. What you have to say is that even if he were eligible, because that's what the court said. The court said, I have listened to what he said. I have listened to the factual arguments. I have listened to the legal arguments. I have listened to what he says about the impact of intervening changes in the law in this matter. And I find that if he were eligible, the 3553A factors counsel against his release. So that being said, it seems as if, regardless of the court's view of the arguments being made today, the arguments that were made before, that there is no reason to release this defendant because the exercise of discretion was well within the wide latitude afforded on the First Sentencing Act.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chase, you've got your rebuttal time.
Yeah, a couple of things. First, what the situation that Judge Grimberg laid out is almost exactly what we're talking about here. He posited a situation where a defendant may have or had an argument for 200 grams and wouldn't have had a reason to, you know, object or raise that because it's still over the 50. And that's exactly what we have in Mr. McCoy's case. There's an argument that could have definitely been made based off of the PSR that he was only responsible for 213 grams because there's two transactions that he's directly involved in, and that's it. And those two transactions are only 213 grams. But it would have made little sense, no sense, to make a statutory objection on that point because you're still over 50. So it really would have been a moot point. And also, as to the 2255 issue, if we were asking for the court to redefine the offense or redefine the statutory finding, like in the Apprendi cases, then that would make sense. But that's not what we're doing here. We're asking you to defer to the actual finding that was made. So it's not a 2255 issue. And then finally,
can I ask you a sort of foundational question? You know, notice in the due process sense is about what is going to happen to you at the moment if you don't take certain steps, right? But here it seems that the due process argument is being extended to circumstances that occur in the future, which are completely unknown at the time a person is sentenced. How is a defendant supposed to be provided any notice at the time of sentencing about any future sentencing amendments by Congress?
I mean, I don't think he can be, and that's the kind of the point. You know, if he can't be provided with that notice, then how can you also hold it against him that he doesn't fight against something that he has no way of knowing about? So there is no way that I can see that you could possibly have provided him notice here, and that's kind of the fundamental problem. Right? If there's no way to provide him notice, then how does he have any way of knowing that in the future he's going to need to make these arguments to effectuate his rights or to assert a defense?
Can I ask a quick question? And I'm so sorry for the screeching in the background here. So it's not just you, Mr. Chase. My IT equipment is melting down, so I've kept myself on mute so it wouldn't bother everybody. But if you can hear me,
okay.
The point you just made, wouldn't that apply not just to your client, not just to Jones and Jackson, but to like everyone? I mean, it's just sort of like in the nature of how these things, there is, you know, sort of an indictment that alleges a certain statutory threshold. And then just sort of, you know, in sort of the workaday world, there is a later finding. So wouldn't this sort of blow current sentencing up just generally?
Well, I don't know about current sentencing, but, you know, they can charge a specific amount. I mean, had the indictment said specifically for statutory purposes, you know, a certain amount, then maybe you could get there. But that's not what we have in Mr. McCoy's case. Mr. McCoy's case, it was charged as just 50 grams. But yeah, I mean, to be perfectly candid, yeah, and what you say is probably correct, that it would blow sentencing up. With respect to all these proceedings, yes. One other point I did want to make, one of the last questions that Judge Jordan asked of Ms. Rhodes, you do need to decide this issue first before you can get to the issue of whether the court reversibly erred in its determination of whether to grant relief, because without deciding this issue first, we don't know if the court considered the proper guidelines. And without having considered the proper guidelines, you can't make a determination as to whether the court, you know, abuses discretion in denying relief. So in other words, because we don't have any kind of a finding from the district court as to what it would have done with the proper guidelines, We now need to send it back with directions from this court to consider those appropriate guidelines and then make a determination as to what sentence should or should not be imposed. So I think that that's everything that I have at this point, unless the court has additional questions.
No, I think that is it. Mr. Chase, we know that you represented Mr. McCoy under the Criminal Justice Act, and we want to thank you for taking on the case, helping us out, and certainly doing a service to your client. We do appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, thank you both very much. We're in recess, and we'll take the case under advisement.
Thank you.
Thank you.